We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Audacy put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Audacy. Visit ads.audacy.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It's Joe Benigno and Evan Roberts on The Fan.
Joe and Evan. Evan and Joe. On WFAN Sports Radio. If you want to be in the New York, no. Gotta go to Joe and
Joe. All right, 405 on the Fan Hour 3 of our radio program. Benigno and Roberts in the afternoon, 877-337-6666 is the phone number here, of course, till 6 o'clock. Big Mike Francesa will come your way. Pete Hoffman on the other side of the glass in Manhattan. Ernie Acosta on the other side of the glass in Yonkers. We're live from the Town Fair Tire Studio. Nobody, 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 and nobody on top of that beats Town Fair Tire. Nobody.
And joining us right now, one of the great hitting second basemen of all time. The Mets made a very big mistake in late 1996 when they traded him away, and that is the former MVP, Jeff Kent. Jeff, Joe and Evan here in New York, how are you?
Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing good, guys. You guys must be two things. One is you've got some people in high up places to get me out of my hole in Texas to give you a call, number one. And number two is you must be really bored if you want to talk to me.
That is not true.
No. You know what, Jeff? Come on. Start with this. Okay, first thing, and we both feel this way, you're a Hall of Famer. I mean, you're one of the greatest hitting second basemen we've ever had, and how you were not in the Hall of Fame is beyond me. Do you think about that, Jeff?
Oh, sometimes. Every end of the year when the reporters want to call me and talk to me about things, they ask me about it. And, you know, it's frustrating at times. And I agree with you. I should have stayed on the East Coast. I would have had more attention. But I went and played on the West Coast, and everybody was in bed by the time they watched me play on the east side of the country. And then I went and played in Houston for a little while, and people forgot about me there too, because you know nobody cares about those teams in the middle of the country. But you know, I don't. My life doesn't rotate around it. I don't worry too much about it. You know, I think it's a great argument piece that people have every year, once a year when it comes around, or when you got to be socially separate like you guys are now. You want to argue about it, but it's nothing that makes my day.
Well, we both think you deserve to be in, and you should be a heck of a lot closer than the votes. And look, you bring up an interesting point, because I think we all often debate why. And I always thought that guys that bounce around the league, and look, it's not like you really bounce around the league. You spent 6 years with the Giants. You won an MVP there. You were part of some really good Giant teams, including a team that almost won a World Series in 2002. But when guys don't have one fan base behind them, yeah. I do wonder if that maybe hurts a guy once they're up for voting for the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and that's a good argument, too, and I thought about that. You know, I was traded my rookie year from the Blue Jays to the Mets, you know, for David Cone, and I got there in New York, and, you know, it's like I was wearing two black eyes. I got beat up by the fans and the media right away because, you know, the Mets at that time were supposed to win, and they traded away Coney, one of the best pitchers that you guys had. For who? Me? You know, who's Kent? Who's that kid? He was just a utility player with the Blue Jays in the big leagues. And then before that, and then the Mets, we tried to do some things with the Mets, and before that happened, they shipped me off to the Cleveland Indians for Carlos Baerga, and I found a home in San Francisco, you know, a few months after that, and stayed there. And then San Francisco had a big turnaround. They let go of Dusty, and then when Dusty walked, I wanted to walk too, so I left and went to Houston and then went back to L.A. And, you know, L.A. was a mess, too. So, yeah that's probably a big black mark on my book, too, is the fact that I traded too many teams.
Well, let's get back to the New York days, because you were a very good Met. I mean, you were. You were hitting 20 home runs a year. You hit about 275. Do you think if the Mets didn't make that trade, and it turned out to be, let's face it, one of the worst trades the Mets ever made. I mean, Carlos Baerga was not very good here. It's led to this long line of terrible second basemen, quite frankly. I was even saying the other day, it's like the curse of Jeff Kent. They trade away this could have been Hall of Fame second baseman, and look what they've gone through. But if you stayed in New York, could you have seen playing here for 15 years? Did you like playing in New York?
You know, I had a conversation with my wife, with the Wilpon family, Fred Wilpon, and he had talked to me about staying in New York prior to my trade. And you know, I was a guy. I'm a half empty guy. I was a guy that saw a problem, and the problem was the Mets weren't winning, and I wanted to help solve that problem. So I was asked, you know, if I wanted to stay in New York, and I told him yes. I want to fight this fight. Mm-hmm. And the Mets, I think, always had a problem with eye candy. And they saw Carlos Baerga as eye candy, and they thought that they could trade me away for that, which would they did. But when I was told I was traded for Carlos Baerga, I don't know who was crying more, Dallas Green or me, because I think Dallas Green knew what he was getting, and you guys got a big turd. And, you know, as much as I respected Baerga for playing, you know, as many years as he did, he gave you guys nothing.
You got that right.
Boy, very, Jeff, very well said.
100% said right about that. Nothing would be the deal. Let's go back to Udo getting traded from Toronto, because, you know, as Met fans, Evan and I are both big Met fans. As Met fans, I was ticked off David Cohn got traded. What do you mean you're trading David Cohn for Ryan Thompson and Jeff Kent? Who are these guys? So I think that kind of puts you behind the eight ball a little bit right from the get go. How about that, Jeff?
It did, and you know, and I'll never forget it too. One of the greatest news headlines that was written about me at the time was Jeff Kent better have Superman sitting on the airplane next to him as he comes from Toronto. Yeah, that was about the headline, and I laughed all day long, not knowing what I was going to get myself into too. And you know, at times I pissed a lot of people off. I couldn't keep my mouth shut sometimes, and you know, just be the good boy and just go play. You know, I had an opinion. I went to college at Berkeley, so everybody at Berkeley's got an opinion. But you know, it was a tough trade for me to come in my rookie year, because I had gone from Double A to the big leagues in '92, playing on the best team, the team that won the World Series too, by the way, in '92, the Blue Jays. So I left that team with you know, great veterans, Dave Winfield and Joe Carter took me under their wing and helped me along playing with those big boys. And you know, and Coney was a great pitcher, and the Blue Jays needed more pitching. They didn't necessarily need me. They needed more pitching to go through the playoffs, or get to the playoffs and get through there to win the championship. And it was a great trade for the Blue Jays, and, you know, and I would like to think it would have panned out for the Mets a little better, but we just didn't have the time. We had some good young players coming through. The Mets were transitioning from, you know, the worst team money could buy. I think you guys know that story well.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Very well.
We know well. Yes.
So they were transitioning away from a lot of these older guys that were getting paid too much money to the younger players. And as you know, too, you got to stick with some of those young boys. We had a great pitching staff. Some of the kids got hurt. And we were in Hundley. We just had young players that needed to get over the hump in New York. And, you know, before you knew it, within, what, 4 or 5 years, I was out of there. And then the Mets start paying for better players, and they got, instead of developing the kids, they just paid and got themselves in the playoffs, you know, I don't know, a few years after I left.
Yep. Yeah, it's funny. Yep. The worm was starting to turn while you were there. And
yes,
in 1997, the team got a lot better, didn't make the playoffs. Same thing in 1998. And, you know, I imagine, man, can you imagine that lineup if Jeff Kent was at second base instead of Carlos Baerga?
Yep.
But did
with Piazza.
Did that trade, when it happened, and I got to admit, I feel bad, but I'm being honest with you, I was into the shiny object too. I said, "Oh, Carlos Baerga, this guy used to be great. This is amazing."
He hit the big word there, used to be.
Yeah, that was unfortunately that was the key word. What were you surprised when the deal went down? I mean, you were mentioning talking to ownership and wanting to be a part of the solution, but when that trade happens in late July of 1996, What was your reaction? Were you surprised, stunned? How was it?
No, I was in big shock. You know, Jerry Hunsicker was the GM at the time. He was a good guy. But he had told us prior to that trade and prior to almost the year, beginning of the year, that he would let guys know if other teams were inquiring about players and if the team had thoughts about trading. So nobody had ever talked to me. I was I was in the locker room, had my shorts on, T-shirt, and I think it was Jay Horowitz grabbed me by the collar and said, "Hey, they want to talk to you upstairs." And, well, what did I do wrong? You know, I thought I was in trouble. So I mean, a few times I got myself in trouble, but they stomped me upstairs. And Dallas Green was sitting there on the couch, and I'm looking at Jerry Hunsicker, and I sat down, and you know, tears started welling up in my eyes because I knew what was happening. They were shipping me off, and I even asked the question, "How come you guys didn't let me know? You know, this was coming." Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, this was just a last-deal trade. And, you know, rightfully, they don't have to tell us as players. I get that. I wasn't too pissed off about that. But, they that was the way it went down, they said. And then when I got to the Indians, they were so happy to have me because they needed a right-handed hitter that could handle left-handed pitching. And I knew I wasn't going to stay in Cleveland for a long time, but that's what they wanted. They got it, and they were happy to get rid of Beierger. I could feel it, too. A lot of those guys were, you know, knew Beierger was just at the end of his career, wasn't going to give him much anymore, and they wanted to get in the playoffs.
Mm, they were spot on. That's for sure.
No doubt about it. We're talking to Jeff Kent, who should be in the Hall of Fame, by the way. So I'm wrong about this, Jeff. So you actually, because I always thought, you know, when you got dealt, they said, you know what? I don't know if Kent is really cut out for New York as a Met fan. I mean, that was what I was going on in my mind, but I'm totally wrong about that. You actually embraced it, and you really wanted to be here.
Well, I don't know if I wanted to be there as much as David Wright, but I wanted to be there because I wanted to win. You know, I got booed at, and we got beat up as young players, and that pissed me off. I wanted to fight. I'm a fighter, boy. I can fight, and I don't know. I'm not an East Coast guy. I grew up in Southern California on the beach, the surfing, and so that was my temperament. That was my attitude. And then they throw me over there, the east side of the country, and I still all my business folks, my agent and financial guys are all New Yorkers. They're all living in New York still to this day. So I got to know more about the people, but I don't know if I can completely tell you I could, you know, hug everybody in New York. I don't think I really fit in, but I wanted to fight for New York. Right. And when I came home, I told the wife we're packing up and leaving. I still had tears in my eyes. It just felt like a job that was undone. And as OCD as I am, you know, leaving a place that I felt like I hadn't accomplished or conquered, if you will, it didn't sit well in my stomach for a long time.
Well, you know what didn't sit well in my stomach? I was happy for you, but when you became one of the best players in baseball, let's be honest. You win the MVP in 2000, you and Bonds are like this incredible middle of the order. And I remember thinking, oh my, this is Jeff Kent. Jeff Kent's one of the best hitters in baseball. For you, what clicked in San Francisco? Because you're always a good player. Now you're driving in 120 runs every year. I mentioned you win the MVP. What clicked for Jeff Kent in San Francisco?
Well, I released a little bit of my stubbornness, and I made some physical, technical changes to my batting stance and my approach. When I went to Cleveland, I started hitting balls because they wanted me to drive the ball in Cleveland, and I was only there for 2 months. So they wanted me to drive the ball a little better in Cleveland, more consistently. Mm-hmm. And I had a hard time hitting the ball off that stinking big old honking wall out there in left field in Cleveland. And I got home, and the wife even said, "Should we leave stuff here in Cleveland?" And I told her, "No, pack everything up. We're going home back to Texas. We're not coming back." And I just knew it. And I sat at home, and I started to reminisce some of the best hitters in the game. And Edgar Martinez was one of them. And I started to pattern more of my stance and approach, my technical stance and the mechanics of how I hit a little bit after him. And a few other guys. Paul Molitor was another guy I really looked at. And so I really physically sat on a tee in the off season with a net in front of me, sat next to a tee, put a ball on a tee, and I started to change and have my swing evolve into something a little different. Now, you go from those physical changes, and then I get on a team with Dusty Baker, who was the best manager I'd ever played for. And he was able to start to pick things out for me and help me apply all of what I was working on. And it just clicked. And then that, and, you know, Barry Bonds and I, we kept pissing each other off all the time. So I still played as an angry guy. And it just took off.
What would he do? What would he do to piss you off, Barry Bonds?
Oh, Bonds, he would always fight with me about, he'd pop off, and we'd be walking down a hallway, and we'd be heading right towards each other. We're going to run into each other. And he wouldn't sidestep a little bit or just move a quarter, and I'd move a quarter so we'd miss each other. He'd just walk straight, and we'd bump into each other. He'd just stupid stuff like that. You know, I'm the macho man, and at spring training, the first time I was there, I was trying to break the ice with him, and we were out in the outfield, and music was playing during spring training, and I told Barry, you know, he ought to dance and show a little bit of his talent dancing, because I knew Barry couldn't dance. And so we ripped on each other that way, and, Barry would be a little lazy here or there, because he was one of the best players I ever played with, too. And so I'd always try to light a fire under his rear end to get him going, and he'd yell back at me, tell me to shut my mouth, and anyway, those are types of, you know, dog, cat and dog fights that we'd always have.
Because I was going to ask you, you really didn't get along with Bonds, right? Is that fair to say?
Well, I probably got along with Barry better than anybody that he'd ever played with during my era with
really?
Barry.
Okay.
You know, I was kind of, if you will, the middleman that was, you know, I loved Barry, hated Barry, and you know, he and I going to go to dinner? No, we're not going to go to dinner. We were so different. It was crazy. But I think we respected and appreciated each other as teammates that, did I get along? Could I say that I got along with them? Yeah, sometimes. Did most of the time not get along with them? Yeah, but did we work well together? Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, that year you won the MVP. I think he finished second. I mean, you guys were, you know, the Bash Brothers reincarnated. And what was that like, especially, and we all probably know what happened with Barry in 2001 and what he was on, but that was one of the most ridiculous seasons I've ever seen. Joe and I say it all the time, probably the modern-day Babe Ruth, to see what he was doing in 2001 and 2002.
Yep, yep.
What was that like, being a teammate and hitting around him in that lineup for that run?
Yeah, I was hitting behind him. I hit behind him except for the last half season of my career with Barry, and I was able to watch all of what he did. He and I hit in the same group during batting practice, too, before each game. So we were always really close together, you know, in the same, you know, hitting off a tee together, soft tossing, hitting in the cage together, hitting on the field together, and then I'd watch him hit, and jaw-dropping for me. Just his careless and carefree, his carefree personality and his attitude and his approach and his fearless, cocky, arrogant personality. You know, Dusty Baker used to always tell me, too, some of the greatest players in the game were all pricks. These guys were all, you know, bad dudes. And, you know, Bonds and Mays and McCovey and, you know, some of the old school dudes, they'll bite your head off if you get in their way. So
right.
Bonds was a little similar to that because that's the family he grew up in. But, you know, for us, it was being able to watch him process and handle ball after ball after ball, and then when he got a pitch, he didn't miss it. It was impressive to watch.
Again, we're talking to Jeff Kent. All right, so you're talking when you're with the Mets, you were upset when you got traded because you wanted to beat Aaron and win with the Mets. So now you're on the Giants, and the Mets are in the playoffs. We're in the 2000 divisional series. And you're playing the Mets in a series that you guys obviously wound up losing to them. What was your thoughts there? And, of course, you got the only hit in that game. Bobby Jones almost pitched a no-hitter, too. So what was your thoughts as you're playing the Mets? Here you wanted to win for them. Now you're trying to beat them. Were you ticked off even more because now you're playing them in the playoffs?
Oh, heck yeah, I wanted to kick your butt. Absolutely. I wanted to shove it down your throat. When I was with any team that I was playing for, I was all in.
Right,
I was
right,
all in. I was
right,
bleeding
right,
that, and I was going right, to do whatever I could
right,
do to win.
Right, right.
And, you know, for me being there and watching the Mets do what they did, then when we lost and I'm watching the Mets play in the World Series, I was jealous for sure. But
right.
At that moment, no, heck no. I wanted to beat every part of the Mets. And if players tell you ever that, oh, yeah, you know, I liked you and I wish the best for you, that's a bunch of crap. Athletes are competitors. They're killers out there. They want to win. So anytime you know, if a player's traded and he goes back and plays his old team, he wants to get four hits in that game and beat your ass all day long. And that's how I was. But it was a respectful way because, you know, you guys could play a little baseball back then too. And
sure.
And I was pissed off that we didn't win.
Boy, and your anger never went away because what I remember, even though the Mets swept the Dodgers in 06, is you were the one guy the Mets couldn't get out. I mean, you were hitting everything in that series. So you kept that I want to kick your ass feeling in 2006 as well, when you were with the Dodgers.
Yeah, I don't know why that was. I was really comfortable in playing against teams that I'd always played with, you know, at one time. And you know, whether it was the Mets or it was, you know, we played against, you know, it was with the Dodgers when I played against the Giants. There was always, I don't know, maybe a sense of peace, but yet there was still fear and fight. And I never really wanted to play better against, you know, you guys versus another team. It was never that way. I still wanted to get four hits in the day every day, but there was just you know, at times I missed New York at times, and there was just a peace and a comfort factor when I played against other teams that that I think that elevated my gameplay. You know, for that day, did it happen all the time? Probably not, but you know, that's probably one reason why I played well against teams that I played in the past.
So 2002, you guys get into the World Series. Okay, you're playing the Angels, and you know, Dusty makes a decision that, you know, probably cost you the World Series, to be very honest about it. How about that? How about that whole series and losing to Anaheim that year?
Yeah, well, you guys are going to make me cry now at the end of our conversation?
Well, I got to ask you that. Right. I mean, I'm not trying to make you cry. I'm just, you know.
We just talked about the Mets beating you twice, too, so we got the other losses.
Don't worry. The Mets didn't win the World Series that year either. and they lost to the Yankees, Jeff, so, you know, you know what that's all about.
Yeah, that was, man, I have a half a dozen regrets about that whole thing. But one thing is I don't regret or second guess Dusty's decision. You know, I was not even in the know or in the process of anything that was happening at that moment. But there's one thing that I do remember that I'll never forget is Felix Rodriguez was on the mound. This was right before, it was Spezio, I think, hit the 3-run home run to either get him real close or tie the game. I can't remember what that hit was. I just remember it was a 3-run home run on about a 15-pitch at-bat. And it was a 3-2 count, and Felix Rodriguez was our pitcher, and he was throwing strike at down and away, fastball, sinker ball, strike. Spezio was fouling him off left and right. Foul off. And I thought for a moment, I ought to call timeout to go stop this because I didn't like the feeling of what was going on. But I didn't want Felix Rodriguez, who could walk people easily. I didn't want to disrupt that rhythm he was having to potentially throw ball four either. So I was fighting my internal emotions, going, should I call timeout and get the rhythm off the hitter? Because I thought the hitter was getting timing on him, and I'm thinking, this is not looking good for us as the defense. So I said no. I'm going to let it go. And sure enough, pitch later, boom, home run. And I put my head down and I went, I should have done something. Mm. And then the other thing was, guys, is inside story too. Is we were winning Game Six. That was Game Six you're talking about.
Yep,
so
yep,
they
yep.
had we were winning that game. So they had put duct tape and plastic all up in our lockers. They had rolled out the champagne in our locker room. All that was in there. And then when we ended up losing the game, they had to rip it all down and wheel everything out because we were coming in the locker room, and you could see the duct tape and some of the plastic hidden in the corners because they didn't get it all because they rushed to get it done. And when we were in that locker room, everything was pitch quiet, and some guys were in the corner crying, and some guys were taking their jerseys off, some guys were just ripping their jerseys off, and their buttons were flying, and I. I sat down, put my head down for a minute, and I stood up and I turned around and I started unbuttoning my jersey, and I'm looking at all the guys in the locker room, and I'm waiting for somebody to say something just to break the ice, and nobody did, and I should have done it. And I make a joke about it in that I should have gone over to Barry and punched him in the face, and then he and I could have gone fighting and just fight, just to fight, just to take the emotion and the stress and the attention off of what just happened. And I sat there and I just unbuttoned my shirt and I took my shirt off quietly and put it up, you know, and I started undressing, and we let it go. And man, if I had two do-overs, buddy, that would have been one of them. Is just say something, just say something stupid, or pop off, or have a conversation. Right. Just and I regret that to this day. I'll never forget it.
Jeff, you're great, man. We'd love to have you on again if you're
anytime,
aboard.
Anytime, Jeff. Man,
we love talking
to
you, man.
Great spot, Jeff. Really was.
Hey, thank you, fellas, and good luck out there in New York.
Good luck, Jeff. And someday you'll get in the Hall of Fame. We keep pushing for it.
We're trying. We're trying for you, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for your 2 cents and keeping the argument alive. Thanks, fellas.
Thank
you. You got it, man.
The great Jeff Kent joining us. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and talk to Nick Swisher, Beningo, and Roberts here in the afternoon.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.